Hey everyone, it's May. Welcome to another episode of the May Lee Show. I know it's been a while, and also my surroundings are a little bit different. That's because I had to teach today at USC, and I really wanted to get this episode out because it's timely. And so I decided to shoot this introduction here in my classroom. So this episode is about April 29th, 1992. It's the 30th anniversary of the LA riots. And we call it in Korean, Saigu. The reason for that is because Sa means four, E means two, and Gu means nine. So 4/29, so the date of the LA riots. Many of you might know something about the LA riots, and some of you might not. But 30 years ago here in LA, there were massive riots that lasted 5 to 6 days. And a lot of those riots were concentrated in Koreatown. What triggered the riots was a verdict by the court here in LA on the beating of Rodney King, a black motorist. Four white police officers were caught on videotape beating him really pretty violently. But the jury pretty much acquitted all of them. And that verdict set off a firestorm, an explosion, literally and figuratively. And a lot of the rioting happened in Koreatown. So the damage that was done, it was major in those couple of days. It was 63 lives were lost, 12,000 plus arrests were made, 3,000 businesses were destroyed, and over $1 billion in damage. And unfortunately, the Korean community incurred a lot of that damage. More than 50% of the loss in dollars was taken on by the Korean community. And then 65% of all the businesses that were destroyed were Korean-owned businesses. So a lot of narratives were going on at the time, most suggesting, especially by the media, that this was a race war, that this was a black and Asian Korean conflict, but also, of course, the black community being very angry about four LA police officers being acquitted for beating a black motorist, Rodney King. But there's a longer history to all of this, of course, because of the systemic racism that has, you know, been a part of our country for so many years and decades. And so I wanted to address some of the issues that sort of encompass why the LA riots happen and where we have come in the 30 years and where we still have to go. So there's a lot of events taking place to commemorate the 30th anniversary. So I decided to speak to someone who is really familiar with this topic because she's worked within the Korean community, but also tried to create allyship and partnerships with the black community and others. And her name is Haepin Im. And she is the president and CEO of a group called FACE LA, which stands for Faith and Community Empowerment. So she basically was really affected personally 30 years ago by the LA riots because she was actually living here and going to school here. In fact, here at USC. And so she started to work on this concept of why is it that this happened? What were the circumstances? What were the misunderstandings? What were all the false narratives that were taking place and all the stereotypes that were created? So she took it upon herself to organize and start building allyship and also trying to learn herself about what was going on, but then also to educate other communities. So I decided to have a chat with her about, you know, everything that kind of encompasses this very complex topic. And one personal note, Haepin and I knew each other, have known each other since college. We went to different colleges, but both in the Bay Area. And so we've known each other a very long time. And so it's really interesting to see our worlds come together in this way again after all of these years. So we started off by talking about why she wanted to get involved in understanding the reasons behind the LA riots, where we are today, and where we need to go. So here's that interview.
Why I think that this is so critical to me is that, you know, I was a USC MBA student, and during that time period when all hell broke loose, right, for the Korean community, you know, there wasn't a ready representation, a voice for the Korean community. And I saw our community being vilified over and over again. And I knew that there was more to this story, and the fact that all their livelihood overnight were all destroyed and devastated, and no one coming along to, you know, help us, protect us, defend us. But, you know, when they tried to rebuild again, the liquor license was taken away. That was a source of income. And then they imposed new restrictions, like they had, and requirements, like they had to add security guard, they had to put lighting, which I felt was really unjust. And so there was a lot of injustices of the lack of political voice and power. But, you know,
and there's also, I mean, you know, I think the really important point to make also is that there was such a lack of cultural understanding, of just basic Korean understanding. Right. Yeah. Not just language. I'm not talking about language. And of course, language was barrier, but just the lack of how Koreans and the traditions and cultural behavior and interactions are. So therefore, when there's none of that, then of course, everything's going to be misconstrued and misinterpreted. Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, even in my current conversations with Black leaders, they say they really don't know us. Yeah. They really don't know us.
Even now.
Even now, and so really, I think there's a part that we need to also, even for the sake of our own life, what is it, survival, it's really critical that we reach out to others, right? I think even more so is that they are completely unaware, because of the model minority myth, that we are suffering too.
Yes.
And so part of this Haegu campaign is to really help open eyes to the reality and the predicament of our community in such a way that it opens eyes and opens hearts. Right. And so going back at the 10th anniversary, when President Bush came, he bypassed Koreatown, didn't even make a sentence
stop,
about-
really? Oh yes. My God, I didn't realize it.
And so, and then, you know, as mentioned, there were no ready known leaders, recognizable leaders in our community. And so they would go to the same individuals who were active during the LA riots. And there were a lot of, you know, I would say politicians, especially from the Black community, or community activists from the Black community, who really, again, vilified our community and the store owners. Mm-hmm. And I saw that happening all over again, where we were being re-victimized. Okay. And so I thought, wow, in my heart, I said, you know, for the 20th anniversary, I'm going to do my part, wherever I am, do my best to ensure that our community's experience and narrative, you know, had a proper place in history, that it wasn't marginalized, vilified, or erased.
Right.
And so another lesson that I took away was that, you know, about 3 days after the event, there was about 100,000 Korean Americans who came out onto the streets for a peace march.
Right.
And I thought that was such a beautiful, powerful moment for our community, when we're hurting, and instead of, you know, revenge, we would say, declare we want peace. But, you know, even though I think media covered it, most people don't even remember anything. And so I realized that, you know, Asians living in America, what we do really is irrelevant to the rest of the world.
Well, it's easily dismissed and forgotten. And I think even to this day, when we talk about the anti-Asian hate that's been going on because of COVID and xenophobia, you know, this time the community seems to be more aware of the fact that this cannot just be some blip again.
Yes.
And then everybody goes back to business as usual.
Yes, that's right.
Because that's what happened after the LA riots.
That's right. That's people, right.
It was a great news story. And listen, I'm in the media. It was a huge news story. It was, you know, violent, and the video was dramatic and all of that. But then eventually, when the fires were put out, and, you know, peace was relatively, you know, it was relatively peaceful again. Yeah, everybody went back to business as usual.
Exactly. And so the takeaway that I came to realize is that, you know what, we need to walk with others, and we need to make sure that others are there with us.
And they're educated. They get yes. the right data points, the statistics, the information to yes. learn yes. and that to be absorbed, which yes. I know that that's something that you're really trying to push,
yes.
right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's what I came to realize. And some of these narratives, which is a lot of misinformation, mm-hmm. Is one that we have really worked to, I guess, enlighten that it is misinformation. So some of the accusations are that these store owners are exploiting.
Right.
And
the Black communities. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And that they're racist and right. That they stole business opportunities from the Black community because we get special loans that they don't get. First of all, you know, my husband was a business broker, $150,000 liquor store. You know, after expense, but before payroll, net's about $2,000 to $3,000.
Yeah, margins are so, I remember reading about this. The margins are so thin when it comes to those small mom and pop stores.
Yes. And you know what was even sadder is the fact that it doesn't cover just one person's salary. That's supposed to cover four person's salary because of the long hours from 7 a.m. to 2 a.m.
Right.
And you need someone at the cashier, you need someone to be stocking. So you need two people, two shifts, that's four workers.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, with $2,000 to $3,000, even for one person, it's not sustainable, but with four. And so what happens is that people take on two shifts and use family labor to make it somehow sustainable. I don't think it's sustainable, but you know, their other options are worse. And so that's how they do it. And then on top of that, there are no loans. there are, please tell me, because that's my job, you know, to tell the community of resources, right?
Right.
Doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, even my father-in-law, you know, he earned his business by basically getting a referral fee from an immigration attorney and got a business loan, business owner to carry the loan. And he got some Korean bank to lend the money. Studies show that there's more Asian-owned businesses when there's Asian-owned banks. And I know in the Korean community, Korean banks were established because no one would lend to the Korean community, right? But the other part that I think people are unaware is that this is a very dangerous job. It has the second highest rate of being killed while working. Number one is taxi driver. The number two is a convenience store employee. So you could just imagine for these store owners, they're working backbreaking hours, right? No vacation, no holidays.
Right.
They're using all their family labor, free labor.
Yeah.
And it's a very dangerous job where they're being assaulted and you know, even shoplifted. And, you know, even when we talk about the LA riots, the story of Sun Jae-do, and Latasha Harlins comes over and over again, that's superimposed. Although, you know, it's strange because it was about Rodney King and the unjust verdict that came with the acquittal of the police officers. But the media, all year long, they played the beating of Rodney King, and all year long before the final outcome had the shot of Sun Jae-do killing Latasha Harlins, you know, in the back, right?
So just for people to, what we're talking about is that was the case of the Korean store owner, Sun Jae-do, who shot a teen because she thought she was shoplifting and killed her. And that really caused an explosion.
And the fact that she didn't have any jail time. And so,
again,
this was going all the same period.
Yeah, that's right.
And so when the verdict came out, all that anger got redirected.
It was a powder keg. Yeah, it was a powder keg just waiting to explode. And the Rodney King verdict was exactly that.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And so even with Sun Jae-do, you know, I read in the case notes, the trial case notes, that she had faced over 40 shoplifting incidents per week. If I'm making $2,000 to $3,000, you know, every dollar is precious.
Yeah.
And even if I am facing one shoplifting incident per week, I think that would still be traumatizing. But 40 a week, I think that would be just like, you know,
yeah, you're pushed to your breaking point in every way. Yeah.
But that's not the worst. Actually, their store had been burglarized 30 times. Mm. And their threats of having their store burned 20 times. And her son's life was being put at risk and being threatened by gang members because he was about to stand as a witness in a trial against one of the gang members for robbing their store.
That's right.
So you could imagine the trauma upon which, you know, this woman, Sunja Du, was, you know, working in. And that's true not just of Mrs. Du, but also all the other store owners who are finding themselves in this situation.
And so, let me give you the other argument that I'm sure you hear all the time. And I think this is why we have to have these conversations with, you know, people from other communities and not just like stay in our silos, which would be, you know, the Black community may say, well, look, you know, these Koreans are coming into our community, taking advantage of us, you know, opening these stores, and they're making money, right? And like you just said, they're barely making money, right? Their margins are very thin, but they're still thinking they're taking advantage of us. And then on top of that, they're being rude. And what did I say before? It's that lack of cultural understanding as well, right? Koreans traditionally, you know, our generation is different, but the older generation, they don't like to even touch people's hands to give money back, right? To give change back. So when they drop it on the counter, some people might interpret that as rude, but that's just very Korean, right? So little things like that they built up, right? To create this evil image, like you're saying.
Yeah. You know, I think though, at the end of the day, you know, we're all human.
Yeah.
And we respond in a human way to human conditions.
Right.
And so, you know, as mentioned, you know, I've been to restaurants owned by Koreans and they could be rude, right?
Oh, totally.
And I would not be very happy with them. I'd be really pissed, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Whether they're Korean or non-Korean, when I get bad customer service, you know, I'm very unhappy.
Right.
And so that is kind of the lived experience that I hear from many Black friends that, you know, they've been to many of these Asian-owned stores and that's what happens to them. And so I really empathize, and that needs to be addressed and corrected, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, I also want to say, like, I just can't imagine what store owner would want to spend their time, right, their busy day, following customers around. Mm-hmm. I believe that that's from an act of desperation when, you know, they're being assaulted and being taken
over and over
advantage
again.
Of in many ways. And when they call the police, nothing happens.
Right.
And they have no cushion, that $2,000-$3,000. And so this store owner also needs help, right, to do better. And so, you know, I often give the example of, you know, yelling at someone in a wheelchair to jump. You know, knowing that they're in a wheelchair is a very critical information, right? But knowing it doesn't take away your need for them to jump. But knowing that they are in a wheelchair changes things up in terms of the conversation you have with them, but more critically, the solution that you come up with to have them jump, right? And I feel like the last 30 years, there's been this ignorance or, you know, a lack of awareness that these store owners are in the same economic wheelchairs. You know, just even nationally, beyond Korean store owners, Koreans and Blacks have the same homeownership rate. People are shocked, but we have the same homeownership rate.
Right.
And there's actually 7 other Asian subgroups that are even below the Black homeownership rate. And there's 12 Asian subgroups that are below the Hispanic homeownership rate. You know, when things are doing well, or people are doing well, the first big major purchase beyond a car, right, is a home. Mm-hmm. And that's an indication of where they stand, where they are. But the fact that we have that same low homeownership rate says even today, things are not easy. Yes, there's few of us that might be doing very well, but the vast majority, we're still hurting.
Every data report, statistic, you know, survey where they come out with the data about different demographics, it always shows that Asians Asian Americans have the biggest economic disparity of any ethnic group.
That's right.
And they're shocked. And people are shocked by that. They're, you know why? Why? Because the stereotype is, wait, aren't you all rich?
Yes.
Aren't you all well off?
Yes.
Aren't you all highly educated? And that's not true either.
Well, actually, you know what? Yes. So particularly the Pacific Islander group has one of the highest dropout, high school dropout rates.
That's
but
right.
Even let's just set that aside. It is true. If we look at our data point, that Asians do shoot through the roof in terms of educational attainment, whether it's a bachelor's, master's, PhD, doctor, professional degrees. So you would think that that would translate into success in the workplace, right? But no, actually studies show that Asians have the lowest likelihood. So in the private sector, Asians are at 55% of being promoted to management, African-Americans 65%, mm-hmm. Latino 74%, and then Caucasian 111%.
But now
in government and universities, you know, because of, you know, more regulations, you would think things, you know, should be better, right? And for the Latino and the Black community, actually their promotion rate goes up significantly.
Yeah.
But ironically for Asians, it goes even lower to 40 and 30%.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you were to define, discrimination based on return on investment, especially in education, I would say Asians have the highest rate of being discriminated.
Right.
I could go on even on COVID-19, you know, New York was the epicenter, when the pandemic broke.
Yep.
And I think it was either March or April of 2020, the increase, in unemployment filing, Asians had the highest rate of increase at 10,000%.
Right.
The next group goes down, it's lower at only 3,000%. I mean, 3,000% is high, but the fact that Asians had such a significant increase, and I believe that, you know, for many Asians, because they have limited English, they end up working for ethnic companies. And many of them don't have big budgets.
Right.
They don't provide health insurance. They don't provide a lot of reserves. And so when all these businesses started to close because of COVID-19 and, you know, China virus and, you know, all that stuff, all the workers, so it wasn't just the business owners that were impacted, but all the workers that also
there was no safety net for them.
No safety net.
And again, because of the cultural differences and the language barriers, they couldn't even properly apply for the loans, right? The PPE loans and the unemployment. A lot of Asian businesses were affected because of COVID, because of the restaurants,
right? That's
Nobody
right.
wanted to go eat Asian food because they thought, oh my God, it's a bunch of COVID-laden food. And then of course, just because, you know, we don't want to ask for help oftentimes, right? Asians want to keep to themselves. And so therefore there's so many reasons for why Asians were hit so hard.
Yes.
And even medically, healthcare, a survey showed that Asians suffered the most during COVID because they
That's
couldn't
right.
go and get help at clinics because some of them said they were afraid to go because they were afraid that they would be mistreated and accused of having COVID.
And you know, actually for the longest time, I don't know the current data, Koreans had one of the highest rates of being uninsured. So you don't have insurance. And then
exactly.
the other piece is that over 20% of all doctors in this country are Asian.
Yeah.
Right.
And what about nurses? I mean,
Over 9%. So again, you know, we are frontline workers, essential business, you know, essential businesses, and all that. And yet again, there's repeated discussions about the sickening and killing of Black and Brown lives, but no mention of the Asian community. Actually, May 2020, Asians had the highest death rate of COVID-19 in LA. But no one ever talked about
Nobody talked about that.
In New York, actually, Chinese, Indian, South Asians, they also had one of the highest like death, infection, hospitalization rate as well.
And so let's then talk about what is needed, you know, to sort of break down all of these stereotypes and dismantle these long-standing narratives, such as the model minority myth, that makes most people think that Asians are all okay and we're doing fine, right? And then, of course, it creates that envy or jealousy because of this artificial stereotype, right?
Yes.
And then, of course, the lack of all of this information, the lack of understanding, the media doesn't talk about it, like as you said, and I completely agree with that, you know, being part of the media. So there's so many layers to this. But from your position at FACE and having done this work for decades and obviously hosting this wonderful event to commemorate the 30th anniversary, what would you like to see more of being done that really truly can make a long lasting impact?
Well, I think that first of all, as mentioned in prior sessions, like we're not on stage, we're not on talking points, we're not on PowerPoints. So inclusion is definitely one that we should all advocate for. So, you know, we are actually partnering with the Korean Consulate as well as one of the LA Unified School District partners to develop an ethnic curriculum specifically on the store owner and the LA riots, right?
Great.
Dispelling some of the myths that I mentioned earlier. And I think that, you know, I hope that the people who are listening will take some of these data points and share with, first of all, Korean/Asian community, because first of all, we need to know. I've been in many rooms where there's only a few handful of Asians, and basically I don't hear them speak because probably most are oblivious to the fact that we are suffering fellow other communities of color.
And also we've been programmed to all think in this manner.
That's right.
Sort of like, oh yeah, Asians are over here. So
exactly.
Don't make any noise. Yes,
exactly. And so in that way, I really invite you to first take the data points that we even shared today. There's a lot more on our website, facela.org. And, you know, first study it, find other forums where you could educate fellow other Asian Americans. Second is build those relationships, reach out to other communities of color, especially the African-American community. I believe that with, you know, years of history of slavery and being dissed, and, you know, that a lot of times they take our silence and our shyness and maybe even being insecurity as actually arrogance.
Right.
And so really, I really encourage each one of you to reach out, say hello, and build those relationships. And I have to say some of my best mentorship opportunities, partnership funding opportunities have come by participating with other communities of color, including from the Black community. So it's actually something that's very rewarding.
I mean, that's the thing, but we have more in common than we have, you know, different.
Absolutely.
Right. And that's when you start having these conversations and learning about each other's histories and experiences.
Yes.
You're like, wait a minute.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
There's a lot in common.
For the most part, what I've heard from Black leaders is we just don't know you. We just don't know you.
Yeah.
And that leads to indifference.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So again, I really, really encourage that each one of us know our own community, but also take time to reach
and
out.
And know our own stories well.
Yes.
And
yes.
So therefore you can be that communicator to your next door neighbor, your colleague, and then beyond. So, you know, here it is, simply put, we need to understand each other. The fact that it's still being said that the Korean community is not understood and the Black community just doesn't know us. And therefore, that probably means a lot of other communities don't either. And I think that just goes to show that, you know, across the board, when it comes to misunderstandings, it's because of the lack of understanding, the lack of knowledge, the lack of awareness, the lack of conversation and engagement. And if we don't talk to each other, if we don't try to learn from each other, if we don't communicate, then we're never going to get anywhere. So if that's still the case in many communities, that there is this division and separation and lack of understanding, we got to fix that. We definitely have to work on it. So each of us can do that. Each of us can try to learn more about our own communities, our own histories, and then share that with other people, other communities, and vice versa. Learn about other communities. Share with each other. Talk to each other. And then we can get somewhere. So hopefully you guys learned something during this episode. Let's hope we all learn from history and move forward together. Thanks for watching, everyone. See ya.